Case number 23-7135. Jane Doe, bonded through her next friend Julie Doe, and Julie Doe, mother and next friend of Jane Doe, appellants, versus District of Columbia and Aquila Claims, individually and as an agent of District of Columbia. Ms. Murray for the appellants, Mr. Phillips for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This case is about, this is a Title IX case that has been brought by the appellant Jane Doe in this situation. This case, as far as there's four counts at issue, I'll just take them one at a time, starting with count one, which is her Title IX count for private action. This count was dismissed on summary judgment by the district court, and we feel that that dismissal was erroneous. It really turns on the issue here of whether the district's response to Jane's report of a sexual assault was deliberately indifferent. And in order to prove deliberate indifference, we have to show that there were facts that could have been construed by a jury as clearly unreasonable in light of the known circumstances. This test considers the disciplinary authority both available to the school and the potential liability arising from certain forms of disciplinary action. It has also been described as examples of where deliberate indifference has been found is described as an official decision not to remedy the violation or the sexual harassment, or where there's a combined systemic effect of sexual harassment and the school's response effectively denies the victim's access to a scholastic program, activity, or school. One of the components of deliberate indifference is to show that the school's indifference to it allowed the victim to be either additionally harassed or made the victim vulnerable to it. This is not necessarily in the case of student and student sexual harassment, which is what we have here, a showing that the victim suffered additional harassment from the student, but rather could be the school's deliberate indifference or the school's own actions being interpreted as sexual discrimination or harassment against the student. And that is what we believe has occurred here.
Does your argument center on the claims of delay? Because the school certainly did respond here quickly, within a day or so. She was offered transfers. Before the next school year, this was at the end of one school year, and before the next school year, she was able to go not just to another school, but to a school of her specific choice.
Correct.
Which Title IX does not require. And there were measures put in place to offer therapy. I think there was like a summer program. And so it seems like may not have been executed well, but at the end of the day, the actions were taken that would, at a minimum, take this out of the deliberate indifference category, unless your point is it just time delay? Or I'm unclear, given that this isn't an unresponsive district.
Sure. I appreciate that question. So it's a two-part, I believe this can be dissected into two parts. I think the first part is what occurs over the summer. Of course, this assault occurs on the last day of school. I think that's undisputed. Once the assault is reported, there is a delay in not necessarily in having the meeting, which Your Honor acknowledges happens the day after, but there is a delay in the school taking any further action associated with this.
Was she not offered a transfer within 48 hours?
It was discussed. She still had to go through, and it was actually her mother who went through and was the person who actually made the request to the transfer office. None of the administrators did that, Your Honor.
But there was an offer from Pindar? early on that she could go?
Dr. Pinder discussed that with her.
Okay. Well, discussed it as in this is an option for you or discussed it?
Well, the way the transfer office works, and this is, you know, something we learned through discovery in this case, obviously, is that if there is a sexual assault or even something that's not a sexual assault, a regular assault, a student or an administrator can apply for a victim safety transfer for the student. That didn't occur on the part of any of the administrators, despite statements to my client's mother that they could go ahead and do that. She had to go and be the one to actually make the transfer request. And when it was made, it was interpreted as a discretionary transfer by the transfer office.
But does that matter? At the end of the day, she got what she wanted? How can that be deliberate indifference? That it sounds like this is sort of the bureaucratic processes and paperwork. And there wasn't urgency because it was over the summer. And so it's a little hard to put that in the, you know, not exemplary category, certainly not best practices category. But it's hard to see how that's deliberate indifference, given how strict that standard is.
Well, so the transfer that they were seeking was a specific safety transfer to two specific schools, either School Without Walls or Wilson High School. The victim safety transfer would have allowed her to do that. Because it was put and funneled through this discretionary transfer, as she was given three schools that were just posited by the transfer office. In trying to make the determination, the transfer office representative, a man named Milo Howard, emailed the various administrators who were responsible for investigating this assault and asked them, essentially, was this, the questions phrased as, was this a valid sexual assault? And at the time that that question was posed, the administrators, at least two of them, had viewed the video footage, which it's undisputed shows her being dragged into the bathroom by the boy, had done the interview with Jane, so knew her version of events. And despite having that evidence, indicated to the transfer office only that the police were not prosecuting. They never discussed the video. They never discussed.
Well, wasn't the only question posed to them by Mr. Howard, what did MPD do?
No, it was this a valid sexual assault?
But then what did MPD do? Or was there a prosecution? I thought he had follow-up questions.
I mean, he did have follow-up questions about MPD, but the initial question was this a valid sexual assault? And of course, schools have their own ability.
They need, I just don't know the paperwork question here.
Sorry, no.
For victim transfers, do they need the police to say a crime occurred?
No, Mr. Howard actually says that you could have that as one factor, but you could also have had another item that was present here that never made it to the transfer office, which would be the letter of resolution from what was at the time the district civil rights office, which found that she had been, I think they characterized it as sexual harassment, but she had been sexually harassed and set up those other ameliorative measures, including the therapy and the summer program that Your Honor discussed. That letter never made it to anybody, the administrators or the transfer office, to allow this to take place. So my point is, all of this taken together in context creates this delay over the summer. She ends up being transferred immediately before school starts. She has additional anxiety associated with that. That's very clear in the record. And it's not until David Pinder learns.
But these same actions had happened, but they'd happened within June and were resolved by the end of June. Would it still be deliberate indifference? So that, you know,
I don't think for that set of facts that it would be. I think the delay is significant. And then the other portion of this argument, Your Honor, is that I'm running out of time and I haven't even gotten to the other three counts here. But the other portion of this argument, Your Honor, is that once she is transferred to Wilson, those administrators are never provided with a letter of resolution. They are never provided any information about the fact that she was assaulted. She starts to miss school in part because she's having these physical.
Can you help me understand the failure to provide that information? Because I can imagine the district being caught betwixt and between, because I don't know if it's policy. Is it policy to share this information among schools? Because I can imagine, because this is in addition to being incredibly traumatic, it also qualifies as sort of medical information, which is generally treated quite privately. And so I can imagine plenty of people saying, I don't want you to be telling other people about this. I want a fresh start at the new school, and then getting mad if they had told the school. And in fact, there are some claims here of distress caused by people at that school having found out why she was transferred there. So how is the failure to tell Wilson folks why she was being transferred there, or being allowed to transfer there, deliberate indifference?
My argument would be, Your Honor, that it could, and I believe this was testified to by David Pinder, although I don't have the citation for Your Honor, but that it would go to at least the top administrators of the school, which would have been at the time Principal Martin. She does not find out about this until.
Is that established policy or a discretionary decision?
I believe that that is established policy to make sure that they know that they have a student who has special needs associated with the finding of sexual assault at another school. I believe that that's what David Pinder was saying.
Even if it's private medical information.
I'm sorry?
Even if it's private medical information.
Well, it's not necessarily medical information that she needs to attend therapy because of that, or that this school system was giving her, in effect, permission to do so, which is where we have the issue here. You know, they don't have that information. She's being marked as absent and unexcused absences. There's very negative repercussions that come with that, given the number of absences. She's eventually kicked off of her cheerleading team. She's placed into the truancy system in DC Superior Court, where she's effectively monitored. And it took not one, but two attempts by her family, herself and her mother, to have these absences overturned. And eventually the district 2 years later.
It was only 10 of the absences that were overturned.
Yeah, did overturn 10 of them. They disputed that.
100 and something.
Yes, they disputed that much more were related to that. And our argument is that Jane's condition at that point had snowballed. You know, she's missing other days for depression related symptoms. She testified about all of this. So I don't think, I think there's an argument here on the part of the district that these absences are due to Jane's own negligence or other things that are going on in her life. There's an attempt by the district to sort of wash their hands of their part in that leading up to this, including, of course, James's comments about her during the meeting, James's attempts to undermine the investigation of the assault afterwards. We believe that those things are clear in the record, Your Honor.
Suppose there was deliberate indifference. Can you help me with your theory of causation? Because you still have to show that the district caused discrimination based on sex. And usually in these harassment cases, the harassment is something akin to a hostile work environment. It's ongoing. And if the district knows about it and deliberately fails to stop it, it is fair to say that the district caused harassment that continues. This is very different. This is a horrible incident, but it's a one-off. She is assaulted. It's done. What's the assault or harassment or discrimination that the district caused in how they deliberately or otherwise responded to this?
So I think it's the response to the assault.
How does that cause?
I think that in and of itself is it is discrimination by the district in response to reporting the assault. So there's the response of the assault, and then there's also, of course, the actions that are taken against her at Wilson. There's two cases that we rely on, Williams versus the Board of Regents of the University of Georgia. That was also a one-off incident where a student is raped in a dormitory by basketball players at the University of Georgia. In that case, the student withdrew from the school the next day, and the 11th Circuit found that the school's response in failing to discipline the basketball players, failing to do any kind of investigation of it for, I think, a period of about 8 months, constituted deliberate indifference and was further discrimination given the severity of what had already occurred.
Your point is this wasn't one off and that there was the assault and then there was the response by people who were supposed to, she wanted to trust that would help and keep her safe.
Correct. Yeah. And to affect certain, certain remedies, right?
My understanding is that just compounded the harm. And you had expert testimony that obviously emotional trauma from the assault itself.
Correct.
And also, particularly for a child, mm-hmm. to learn the people who are supposed to protect her are, in her view, turned against her.
Absolutely.
And so that's the sort of second harassment.
That's the additional harassment that occurs after the report, Your Honor. Yes, correct. It's not another student's harassment.
What's the 11th Circuit case? Sorry.
Williams versus Board of St. Regents.
Got it. Thanks.
Thank you. Any further questions? I'm 6 minutes over my time.
That's okay. We're nice with the talk
sure.
here.
So there's not a lot of case law that interprets retaliation in the Title IX context.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
And the case law does say that for the municipality to be liable, it's only liable for its own conduct and not for the conduct of individual actors within its purview. And you agree that that's the same rule with respect to retaliation? So we don't need to just look at, for example, Principal James. We have to look at the overall response.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I do think James is part of that. And there is a case which indicates that the school, the highest administrator at the school, which of course is her at the time, is the assault occurs and is reported, is an agent for the district. So I do think that her conduct, as it relates to the comments that she made in the June 14th meeting, and then really her actual actions taken afterwards. I know much has been made of despite her comments, she called police.
I think that you definitely have a stronger case if we just look at Principal James, but I guess my question is The law requires us to look at the overall response, including Pinder and other people who I think responded appropriately.
I think that's true. And I do think there are people who responded appropriately. But I think as far as the retaliation goes, James's comments can't just be looked at as solely comments. There were actions that were taken that David Pinder testified about, misleading comments to him about what the video showed in particular, which, again, caused harm to Jane, caused delay in the transfer. And then once she is transferred, of course, this additional the finding of the sexual assault never made it to Wilson. And I do think the fact that Wilson is marking her as absent for therapy appointments that were sanctioned, as well as other things that were going on in her life, like depression, putting her in the truancy system, all of those things can add up to retaliation, Your Honor.
I'm also interested in this intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. And it just seems like the elements of that cause of action can be met based on what Principal James did, but perhaps not. It's not in a straightforward way, because if it's just a question of whether this should get to a jury, I think that what she did could be considered extreme and outrageous. You know, there was a sexual assault allegation, and without any investigation, she called it BS.
Right.
And then she said that she was going to call the police in order to embarrass the victim. And so I think that that could be viewed as extreme and outrageous. And it did cause, as I mean, you could arguably say it caused emotional distress to Jane Doe because Jane Doe overhears this. And there is evidence in the record from a psychiatrist that this amplified the trauma for Jane Doe. And I guess the thing that is a little bit unusual in this factual circumstance is that Principal James didn't intend for Jane to hear that comment. But I have not been able to find any case law that requires that kind of specificity. If there is extreme misconduct and intent to harm, she said she wants to embarrass the sexual assault victim before the police, and it did cause that kind of, I guess, damage. It seems to meet the elements, and I haven't been able to find a case law that seems to support the district court's analysis, which says that because Principal James didn't intend for her to hear it, right, it doesn't count. I'm struggling a little bit with what to do with this factual scenario.
I agree with Your Honor that there's no case law requiring that specificity. There's not a ton of case law in the district on this point.
Or anywhere that I could find.
Yeah, I don't have anything that specific.
Does it require only intent, or I thought recklessness was also sufficient?
Recklessness is part of it, and
it's sufficient instead of intent.
Correct.
Reckless to make comments like this when the
particularly
child is outside the door.
Particularly considering the context, right? This occurred in a meeting. This is not a private meeting that she was having with her colleagues about it after the fact. This is during the reporting of the sexual assault, just why right after the child had become distraught and walked out of the room and was standing just outside, immediately outside the door. I do think those factual circumstances.
I thought there was evidence that I don't know if she could discern words, but could hear the voices talking.
Correct.
And is it that the words themselves are extreme and outrageous, or is it that you have the head of the school with the people gathered there? You know, he wasn't talking to himself. He talked to the people who he called to investigate this matter. And then without any knowledge whatsoever of what's going on, immediately
make these comments.
Tells them that this whole thing is BS, and he's out to embarrass her. That's his goal. And by the way, look at that dress she's wearing. To the very people who are supposed to investigate this.
Yes, yes.
And then there's a further act of lying to Dr. Pindar about the content of the video.
Correct.
I mean, to be fair, they were hand in hand only because he was hauling her in the bathroom by holding on, maybe with my hand to wrist, probably more accurately, hauling her in there. But that was a complete falsehood to interrupt. You know, I'm trying to get to, is it just the comments themselves, or is it that he's sort of trying to skew the investigation against her, the school's investigation, from the outset, and then continues to take additional
action? I think it's all of the conduct, and I think the case that's dispositive on that is Drasia. Granted, the district's argument is that those comments were made directly to the victim's face in that case. It was a detective who was supposed to be investigating a report of rape. But what that case says is you have to take into account the circumstances, the position of authority, the entire tone and flavor of the conversation. And the tone of the meeting was certainly aggressive towards Jane,
well,
which is
power
why
dynamic
as well as the power.
Now, maybe it's not face to face, but you're talking about a power dynamic between a principal and a child.
Correct. It's very similar.
In that case, there's another case that says sort of
it's Drasia that talks about the power dynamic,
right,
but that's
right,
in the
context. There's another one that talks about children having special, you know, that it's just different.
Yeah,
for
I believe
an extreme conduct is different when you're dealing.
That's a case that we addressed in our section on the negligent infliction of emotional distress. But it certainly would carry over to this intentional infliction, Your Honor.
Do my colleagues have further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A couple minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Graham Phillips on behalf of the appellees. Unless the court would like me to start elsewhere, I'll begin with the Title IX discrimination claim. And we think that this claim fails for either of two broad reasons. First, because the district was not deliberately indifferent because its response to Jane's assault was not clearly unreasonable. And second, and independently, there's no evidence that the district's alleged indifference caused the type of further harm that's required under Davis to sustain a private action for damages.
Can I ask you to focus on the retaliation component of Title IX in particular? First of all, is James as a principal type of senior enough official under Gebser in that she had the authority to control responses to retaliation within the school such that she would be responsible or what do I forget the word in the case, but accountable official for that purpose?
Right. So I think the answer is different depending on who it is that you're talking about performing a retaliatory action. So
if we talk about James herself retaliating as in, again, really upset about this complaint, sexual assault, so spews venomous words to the very people who are supposed to do an objective investigation, but who report to her. And then there's at least evidence in the record, a jury would, you know, I'm not saying right or wrong, but there's evidence in the record about talking to the police officers, and then the police officers were hostile when they interviewed Jane Doe. And then there's the lie to Dr. Pindar about the content of the video. And if those actions are viewed as retaliation for the complaint being filed, and I guess she got the transfer and things like that, but I don't see what the district did to undo the impact of those retaliatory acts on the investigatory process, including the MPD process. And so if James is the person who is the one who would be responsible for redressing or counteracting the retaliation, it didn't happen here.
So there's a lot in your question, Your Honor, and there are a lot of responses to different pieces, but I think I'll start with what I think is where you started, and I think is maybe the most important piece about this. For purposes of the school district having actual knowledge, Principal James's knowledge of her own alleged misconduct does not count. That comes directly from Gebser. Gebser says that the knowledge of the wrongdoer, him or herself, is not pertinent, and that conclusion is also supported by
It was is it Jackson versus Birmingham, the one where the coach reported discrimination against the school, the girls' sports team, and it was the board that retaliated against the coach, and it was the board that was the responsible official under Title IX. So it can be the same.
I think that's because the board itself is essentially the official policymaker. It is itself the entity. Principal right. James is not the funding recipient, so she is separate.
No, but I thought they said in Gebser people who have the authority to address. I'm not talking here about the whole transfer and that thing. That seems like there's different parts of the district that deal with that. But when it comes to the retaliation about this school investigation and the MPD,
I understand that, but Gebser says that the wrongdoer's own knowledge is not relevant. And if you think about the facts of Gebser, and I think it's helpful on this point to really.
How did the board in Jackson have notice? Because they only had notice because they were the wrongdoer.
Well, I think
it was the wrongdoer.
Right. I think there is a distinction when the knowledge is directly to the funding recipient itself, the board. And here, that would be, knowledge by, I think it would probably be the chancellor of DCPS.
It has to be the chancellor only?
No, but Your Honor,
Could it be Pindar?
Oh, if Pindar had knowledge mm-hmm. of James's wrongdoing, that counts. Yes, yes. And when he did have knowledge of her alleged wrongdoing in this case, he took reasonable corrective actions. That's part of why her conduct cannot constitute retaliation.
But what corrective actions were taken to deal with the retaliation? I get that they were to deal with how the sexual harassment claim was processed and dealt with, the transfer, those things. But the retaliatory steps to sort of ruin the investigation before it started and, to ruin the to be clear, all I'm doing here, because we're at summary judgment, is considering the facts in light most favorable plaintiff. I'm not, in fact, saying that any particular view of this is right or wrong. But if we view it from that lens, he's also sort of the police whisperer and then skews their investigation before it even starts.
So, Your Honor, I mean, one thing, this notion that she skewed, that Principal James skewed the police investigation, I think is totally dropped out of this case on appeal. That is not something that on appeal is listed as an alleged retaliatory action. And I think the reason why that's the case is, as the district court explained in some detail, there is no admissible evidence that Principal James said something poisonous to the police about that. So that's not.
Was there inadmissible evidence to that effect?
Well, I mean, all there was Jane Doe's and Julie Doe's understanding that she had said something to the police. But they didn't have any knowledge. Well,
they were there. Did they not witness the talking? Did somebody witness?
Well, they did not witness Principal James saying something to the police that was inappropriate.
Did they witness talking? I'm sorry, witness saying something inappropriate is what I'm asking. Did they witness James talking to the police?
No, I don't think there's any evidence of that.
Surprised nobody deposed the police officers.
Nobody deposed the police officers. Principal James's deposition is that she never talked to the police officers. And there's no direct evidence that she did. She directed that they be called and they showed up at the school.
And she said she was doing so to embarrass Jane Doe. And then the police were quite hostile to this. Apparently, there's evidence of the record that when the police spoke to Jane and Julie Doe, they were kind of hostile.
Well,
so that suggests that perhaps something did happen. But I think without deposing the police officers, I don't know.
That's right. I mean, I think the only direct evidence you have is the recording itself. And
to whom did the police officers had to talk to somebody when they arrived?
That's right. They are, if you listen to the recording, and although we think the making of the recording was improper, we don't object to this court listening to it. They arrive and they arrive in the room and they talk with Jane herself. And I think they talk with the intervention coach.
The one that James had just skewed the view beforehand was the intervention coach that was in the room when James was making these comments. That I'm bringing the police here to embarrass this person. This is all BS. And that person who reports to James?
Yes.
Then interacts with the police and suddenly the police are hostile? That's not evidence.
Your Honor, I don't think there's evidence that.
Isn't evidence a reasonable jury could infer?
A couple things, Your Honor. Again, I think this whole issue of poisoning the police investigation has dropped out on appeal. And I think this court should focus on the arguments that the parties made. So I think it's out of the case.
Looking at the district court summary judgment decision here.
That's right, Your Honor. But I think this court's position on appeal is to address the arguments that Jane has chosen to make on appeal. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you will find any such theory in her brief. So if I could return to on the question of whether Principal James's knowledge of her own wrongdoing is itself knowledge to the funding recipient, I think that's foreclosed by Gebser. And again, I would suggest looking at the back and forth between the majority and the dissent in Gebser about that point, because the court's sort of definition of who is an appropriate person turns on their authority to correct the harassment. And as the dissent there said, well, that's obviously true in a teacher-student harassment case. Obviously, the teacher themselves has the corrective authority to stop sexually harassing the student. But the problem is that their knowledge of their own wrongdoing is not treated as knowledge.
It's clear from Gebser that had the principal in that case known about the teacher-student sexual harassment, that would have been, the principal would have been sufficient either?
Oh, no. And we don't dispute. I mean, it may depend on some vagaries of state law, but I think in the average case, if a principal knows about a teacher's sexual harassment, that is sufficient knowledge.
The principal's not the funding recipient.
That's right. I mean,
so the test isn't whether a funding recipient.
That's correct. It's whether a person with sort of sufficient corrective authority knows, except
the highest person in the school is the one who's also doing their harassing. There's no claim, but anyone below that person, there is. But you were saying that it had to be knowledge by the recipient of funds, and the principal, the school, is indirect recipient of funds, but the funds are going, I assume, to the district or Department of Education or something.
Yeah. So I guess I would direct, I think the best way to think about this or a helpful resource and think about is we cite these cases. They're the MS XREL Hall case from the Third Circuit and the Salazar case from the Fifth Circuit. They're about exactly this issue. They're the only Court of Appeals decisions that I know of that are on this issue. And they both hold together that a wrongdoer's knowledge of their own wrongdoing, even if they are a principal, assistant principal, is not itself enough to trigger.
Again, those cases aren't binding on us. So why? You started by saying GEPs are foreclosed because
yes. The
principal is and the school are not funding recipients, but that has fallen away because someone with sufficient authority to address the retaliation within the school is all we need. And if it turns out that the one unquestionably that holds that position, the principal, also is the perpetrator, they get off scot-free under Title IX, but everyone underneath them wouldn't. That seems an odd rule to adopt.
So I think the way that what Gebser cites for it is the restatement of agency. I think it's section 280, where they say, for purposes of this knowledge inquiry, the wrongdoer's own knowledge is not pertinent.
So am I correct that under this test you want us to adopt, when the principal is the perpetrator, no Title IX liability just because the one with the most authority became the most abusive person in the building?
If no one else with correct...
If no one else that could correct the principal...
Oh, the superintendent could.
No, within the school. I'm talking within the school. Because you agree that it can be someone within the school, which is only an indirect recipient of the funds, correct?
Yes.
So we don't have to find that it's always someone outside the school, someone with... Again, I don't know which entity gets the funds in D.C., the district, or its Department of Education, but whatever it is.
The short answer is yes, Your Honor. If the principal is themselves the wrongdoer and they're the only person with knowledge of the wrongdoer...
If anybody else in the school under them is the wrongdoer and the principal knows, that's sufficient.
Yes, I think, again, unless there's some kind of weird situation of state law about authority, then yes, that's the result.
It's like an odd rule.
I don't think it's any odder than the circumstance in Gebser itself, where, again, it was a teacher sexually harassing the student. The teacher themselves obviously has the authority to stop doing that, but their knowledge of their own wrongdoing is not considered
sufficient. Yeah, but the teacher is not in a self-supervisory position in the formal way, in the way that a principal is in charge of running the school, running everybody in the school, and implementing legal policies within the school.
I mean, well...
This seems to be a materially different point.
I mean, I think certainly in the District of Columbia is subject to additional supervisors, including the superintendent. And here, again, when the
A lot of this doesn't get outside the... schools can be their own communities. It just seems an odd rule to me, I guess I'm repeating myself, and I'll stop there, but that it is sufficient under Title IX for everybody in the school, if they engage in appropriate conduct, that they will be subject to Title IX unless the principal addresses the problem. But when the principal does it, they're just carved out of liability.
Yeah, I'm afraid...
Unless somebody happens to somehow get noticed way outside to some other building miles and miles away where somebody in the district superintendent's office or the Department of Education happens to hear.
I mean, I do think that is the upshot of Gebser, and I think it's based on the principle and these decisions from Third and Fifth Circuits talk about it, which is that, in this private action for damages, which is a judicially created right of action, we're trying to the extent possible, kind of parallel the administrative scheme, which really is based on the notion that the funding recipient will be notified of discrimination and given the opportunity to fix it. And so when in the instance where it is a principal who's doing the wrongdoing, that does require that someone higher up the chain be given that knowledge and the chance to fix it, which is, I think, what a chance to respond reasonably to it, which I think did occur here once Superintendent Pinder became aware of the wrongdoing.
So what's the alleged retaliation? What's the actual retaliatory act alleged by the...
So I think there are two alleged instances of retaliation that are actually preserved on appeal and presented on appeal here. So the first is Principal James's recorded comments. And the second is her being marked as absent without excuse in Wilson during her junior year. I think with respect to the recorded remarks, I think the main thing that I've already talked about is that when the response, the person with corrective authority learned about those things, Superintendent Pinder, he acted not unreasonably to respond to them and launch this investigation on Principal James, and she was reprimanded for this. So I think that, among other reasons, I think that defeats that. And also because, and Your Honor, I think this might go...
Was anything done to address the impact of James's comments on the other people in the room who were responsible for conducting this investigation?
I don't think...
Talk to them and say that was wrong. Make sure you're going full throttle on this investigation.
Not that the record...
It was clear that there were other people in the room.
Yes.
Subordinates of James to whom these comments were directed.
That's right. There were other school officials there who heard these comments.
There's no evidence that anything was done to redress the impact of retaliation with them.
Well, I don't...
To make sure they didn't get sucked into this retaliatory process.
Correct. I don't think there's anything on that point. I also don't think there's any evidence that anyone else at the school did anything even arguably wrong in responding to these allegations. And I just would take a second on this deliberate indifference point to, I mean, run through the things that the school district did here. Immediately called the police, immediately collected the security camera footage, which was important. Within days, Superintendent Pinder agreed to let her to transfer schools. And over the course of the summer, sort of expanded the transfer options available to her, conducted a Title IX investigation that substantiated her allegations and proposed a bunch of remedial measures, including, most importantly, separating the two students if they both returned to Roosevelt.
Let's take this as a hypothetical. Yep. If a school district, school says you can transfer to one of the schools. I can't remember if it's Davis or Gepps, or they don't get to prescribe every single aspect of the remedy. But if the offer is to transfer to schools that are actively worse, either academically or safety wise or both, this is hypothetical. I don't know the status. But if a school were to only offer the victim the option of going to a worse worse educational opportunity, that would not be an adequate response, would it?
I think quite possibly not. If that was sort of the only thing they offered is, we're going to prevent further sexual harassment by letting you, the victim, go to a worse school.
That would be depriving of a equal educational opportunity. I'm baking in a lot of assumptions here that it is.
I think arguably, yes.
And then whether it's true or not, that was sort of the reaction that Jane Doe and her mother had to the schools that were offered until Wilson was offered, I think.
That's right. I would say that was their subjective reaction. And I don't think there is.
I'm not saying, to be clear, it was a hypothetical.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think.
But
something...
in fact, I take it there's no summary judgment evidence on this. But if you had a case where it was shown, just to be clear, it is not an appropriate response to put the victim in a worse educational position.
I think that's right. And I think in the record here, there is DCPS's sort of grievance policy. And actually, one thing it talks about in there is about how the response should not be to sort of force the victim to go to a different school or change their how they're experiencing school.
To what extent do the deliberate indifference claim and the retaliation claim kind of rise and fall together? Because both seek to hold the district responsible. The district's only responsible for its own conduct. And if the district's response was all the things that you said, that's not retaliatory. I'm just wondering, is there any difference in the factual predicate under retaliation versus deliberate indifference?
I mean, I do think they are analytically distinct, and you could imagine a version of this case where, under different facts, there is some action that does qualify as retaliation, but doesn't amount to just straightforward sort of discrimination under Title IX. I guess that's in part because, in judging the reasonableness or not of actions under the discrimination test, you're asking whether they're reasonable in terms of preventing the sexual harassment from recurring or continuing. But that is not what you're asking for retaliation. So it would be possible, you know, for there to be some action that's sufficiently adverse, taken with the requisite intent, but doesn't go to whether it's likely for the sexual harassment to recur or.
But in this case, is it your position that the district's response was not retaliatory because it was all of those things that also you're relying on to say they weren't deliberately indifferent? I'm just trying to understand whether there's a different factual predicate.
I think it mostly overlaps, Your Honor. I think the one piece of the retaliation where maybe we would think about them slightly differently is the one and only other allegation of retaliation on appeal that I think is preserved, which is the marking her as absent without excuse in her junior year at Wilson. You know, that cannot sustain the Title IX discrimination claim for various reasons, one of which is even if that was the wrong thing for the school to be doing, that did not make it more likely that she was going to be sexually harassed again. The reason it's not sufficient for retaliation, I mean, the main reason is that there is no evidence that these mistakes occurred with retaliatory intent. So that's one place where I think the analysis works out a little bit differently. I recognize I'm well over time. I would be happy to address some of the court's questions about IID if you're interested. So with respect to Principal James's comments themselves, I don't think they satisfy the outrageousness element or.
Let's assume that they do.
I hope I can try to persuade you later that's not correct, but let's assume that they do. I think the reason.
I mean, at least a jury could find it so. I mean, I don't have to decide if it does or doesn't, but could a jury find it so?
Let's assume that a jury can. Then I think the reason the claim fails is the lack of evidence of intent or recklessness to cause Jane, through these comments, to cause her severe and extreme distress. So it's undisputed that Principal James did not intend for Jane or Julie to hear these comments. She made them when they were out of the room.
Do you think that it's an element of the offense that the perpetrator has to intend for the victim to know that they intend them harm?
It has to be. I mean, if we're saying that the comments themselves are the outrageous conduct, it has to be that the defendant intended to cause extreme distress.
Well, I think you can infer that, or a jury could, based on saying it's BS and I'm going to embarrass this person. There's an intent to harm Jane Doe. I think what the district court relied on was that there was no intent for Jane Doe to hear it. And it's not clear to me that that works.
I think it does, Your Honor, because I think we have to separate. Did she intend for her conduct? Are her comments evidence that she intended for her subsequent conduct to cause Jane harm? I understand that theory because what she says is I'm going to embarrass her. But what she says she's going to embarrass her by doing is by calling the police. And that is not extreme and outrageous conduct. That is appropriate conduct.
It says to the people who are in charge of the investigation, this is BS. And by the way, look at her dress. I'm out to embarrass her in vulgar terms, no less. And if that's to tank the investigatory process going forward, couldn't a jury find it's reckless as to whether tanking this investigation going forward, poisoning the minds of the people who are going to be conducting it, is going to cause additional serious harm? We're talking about a child here who is supposed to be able to trust the adults to protect her. And suddenly they're all telling her, you're lying, you're lying, you're lying. The jury couldn't find that compounds severe emotional distress? Compounding, I should say, severe emotional distress.
Just to be very clear, Your Honor, I'm not saying these comments were appropriate. I just want to make that very clear. And I think that's common ground, that these were inappropriate comments.
I'm asking a specific question about either intent or recklessness to tank the investigation. And at a minimum, if not knowing, it does seem like he was out with antagonism to get either her or her mother and tanking the investigation so that this child knows without having investigated at all. It's one thing if she'd come to a different conclusion. No investigation whatsoever. We're not believing the girl. We're out to destroy this investigation. To think, is that a minimum reckless that that would not cause additional trauma? And you cannot trust the adults around you to protect you? You're a child in school.
So, Your Honor, one thing, not that I think it's legally relevant, but Principal James is a woman. And I...
I'm sorry, did I say he?
I thought you did.
I did. I think it's because it's James. I keep... I apologize.
No,
yes, she.
So, I don't... Well, for one thing, I don't think the comments themselves, though inappropriate, evince an intent to tank the investigation. I mean, the nature of what she says is she's going to...
Okay, the only issue here is whether a jury could find it did. And a jury could find that the person in charge of the school saying, without even seeing the videotape, that it is BS, that that tanks the investigation because it's telling everybody who's supposed to be in charge of looking into this at the outset that it's BS. So a jury could find that that is outrageous and tanking the investigation.
I don't think a jury can find that the principal intended these comments to cause James severe... I don't think they can find that she was reckless either, because again, there was no basis for Principal James to think that Jane would ever hear these comments.
So that's my question. Does the perpetrator have to intend for the victim to know that she's doing these outrageous things? There is a case, it's Holman versus Goyle. And that's a case in which the defendant gives a stalker information about the plaintiff, knowing well that the stalker is going to use that information to harass the plaintiff. So the phone number, the home address of the plaintiff. And it doesn't seem that that case contemplates that the perpetrator had to know that the victim would find out that the perpetrator did it, because Jane did overhear this and knows what Principal James's intents were. And that's what caused her extreme harm. So it just seems to me the elements are met. Potentially, a jury could find extreme outrageous conduct, that this extreme outrageous conduct caused harm because Jane found out about it. And there's testimony that there's damages. There's a psychiatrist saying this amplified her trauma. And the only thing that the district court and apparently you have to, I guess, contradict that is that she didn't know that Jane was listening. And I don't know that that's enough to evade liability under these circumstances.
So it's not the only thing we have, but we're accepting this, your premise that this satisfies the outrageousness step. So I'm putting that to one side.
I'm saying outrageousness and causation. The only thing in the standing in the way is you're saying that she didn't intend for her to hear this.
That's right.
Or I did intend to hurt her by embarrassing her, but I didn't intend to hurt her by her hearing this. That just seems to be really cutting things very fine.
No, I don't. I think it is appropriate to distinguish between an allegation that her conduct in, for instance, the assertion that she misdescribed the video to Professor to Superintendent Pinder. That's
knowingly mischaracterized, a jury could find.
That's right. That's right.
That's different than misdescribed. Knowingly or intentionally mischaracterized, a jury could find.
Right. So I do think there's a distinction between those two things. And for that, the problem there is that there is no evidence that caused Jane the extreme distress that's required by the IED tort.
It could be viewed as evidence of Principal James's intent. That, you know, she said it was BS. She said, I'm going to embarrass her. And even though Jane didn't know it, there's more evidence of that intent based on other things that she did that Jane didn't even know about. But that doesn't mean it's irrelevant or it's not admissible.
I mean,
but my question just is, it just seems to me that you're saying because Principal James didn't intend for her to hear this, that's what precludes liability. And I don't know of any case law that says that.
I confess that I don't know of any case law that directly addresses that point. I just think it follows logically. You have to intend, the person has to intend that the outrageous conduct will cause the plaintiff extreme emotional distress.
So and there's but this is logically, she intends her harm. She says so explicitly, I'm going to embarrass her. She overhears it. And so the harm has been done. And just logically, why should this principal escape liability just because she didn't intend for her to hear that when she was doing extreme outrageous things and she did hear it?
Well, I think part of it is because, And the case law, I think, bears this out. And I think the Drazia case bears this out. You know, this is a narrowly confined tort. It has to be extreme conduct. That's a very high bar.
Assume we have that met.
And it has, and I think it has to be extreme conduct that you intend to cause the extreme emotional distress.
Yes, but you don't. Imagine, so this is a hypothetical. Imagine you have a principal and a similar sexual assault allegation. But before the student even comes in, there's zero chance of overhearing reporting or anything. The principal engages in a conspiracy with all the people involved in the school that are going to be in charge of investigating this, and as well with the district. The principal says, this person, the student's family, they're royal pains, royal irritants. They're nothing but troublemakers. They're always suing everybody. They're always making up claims. We need to teach them a lesson. This is a total BS claim. And we need to make sure this investigation exposes them for the frauds they are. Now, there's no chance the victim or family members are going to hear about this. It's a really good conspiracy encoded in everything, and everybody's sworn to secrecy. And it never, in fact, comes out until later in discovery and litigation that there was this conspiracy. But in fact, the investigation is tanked. The child is told again and again, no one believes you. You're a liar. We think you're a liar, or that you wanted this, that it was consensual, which causes evident, you know, provable, the jury could find additional harm. Is it your position? I think you would admit, or tell me otherwise, that would be extreme outrageous conduct that causes harm relevant for Title IX. Is that correct?
Well, for Title IX or for IIED, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, IIED. I apologize. Brain not shifting.
Yes, but I'd like to explain why. I mean, I think the reason why is because there, I think what the true extreme and outrageous conduct intended to cause harm is the conspiracy and the subsequent tanking of the investigation. And those secret comments that we learned about later mm-hmm. sound like smoking gun evidence mm-hmm. of intent. But that,
right.
But that what actually is the outrageous conduct that intentionally inflicts the harm is the sort of subsequent.
Right. But you wouldn't change it just without it. So if we then change the hypothetical so that the principal without investigating is just convinced this thing is a fraud, and that we just need to get rid of this and make a clear message that we don't have fraudulent allegations like this in our school. So it's not intending to harm in that sense, but is reckless as to the conclusion that this is fraud and needs to be shut down. It would be the same.
I mean, again, I think if you're positing that then they actually sort of do inappropriate things to tank the investigation, then
inappropriate. They just continually say, we don't believe you. We don't believe you. But yes.
Yes. Would say that's inappropriate if they're not sort of investigating
right,
with
right,
good
right.
faith. Yes.
Right.
Right. Right. But I think the distinction here is that
No, I'm just so your answer to Judge Pan's question of does the victim actually have to hear it face to face or know about it is no, that's not required.
That's right. That's not a categorical rule for all IIED things.
So it's just a question of degree then on how harm to the, you know, telling subordinates that don't even bother with this investigation, it's bullshit. Could a jury find that this was sufficiently like that? And because of all the ensuing things that happened, caused additional emotional distress because of distrust in adults around her. This is just a difference on a continuum.
That's right. I think you would need outrageous conduct sort of that causes extreme distress in the misconducting or non-conducting of the investigation.
Well, I mean, the distress will come from, you know, the child's not going to be upset about paperwork not processing correctly. It's going to be the outcome of adults around her disbelieving her and, in my hypothetical, blaming her, or that would be the source of the harm, even if the child doesn't know where this is coming from, right?
Yes, I think you still have to have
intent or recklessness. Yes.
Yeah, and something about like the actual nature of how the investigation was done, that these secret comments are evidence was done with the requisite intent.
The comments and the ensuing response would be what would cause the harm to the child. The child's going to perceive the harm as, I'm not protected, they're blaming me, it must have been my fault, people think I'm a liar, but I'm telling the truth. That's the harm that that person's going to feel, right?
Yes. Right. I think my basic point is that if you're asserting, and that's the assertion in this case, that the comments themselves are the outrageous conduct that causes the harm, then if they are made with no intent that they ever be heard, then that...
Or acted upon. We just said they don't have to be... I mean, they have to be heard by staff.
No, I mean sort of ever heard even through a chain.
So is it your position then that if the defendant does something extreme and outrageous, which evinces an intent to harm the plaintiff, and the plaintiff learns of this and it causes her extreme distress, there's no liability if the perpetrator didn't intend for her to hear it?
If all you're talking about is if the comments themselves, you're saying that's the injurious, that's the outrageous conduct.
Why am I limited to that? The whole thing is extreme and outrageous. That she's making comments and calling a sexual assault victim's allegations BS. That she's saying, I'm going to embarrass her in front of the police. That she's potentially tanking the investigation. All of it is extreme and outrageous. And the victim hears this and it causes her extreme damage. And this is the principal of her school who is supposed to be taking care of her. So she has heard it. And I think I hear your position to be, if it wasn't intended that she hear it, there's no liability, even though there was intentional or reckless intent to cause her harm. And it did cause her.
So I don't think the conduct that supposedly actually caused, separate from the comments themselves, the conduct that the comments refer to and that, again, calling the police is not itself extreme and outrageous conduct. And I don't...
Calling the police in order to embarrass the victim, a jury could find, is extreme and outrageous conduct.
I mean, I don't think so.
For the whole purpose of embarrassing the sexual assault victim in front of the police?
I don't think it...
That's... A jury could find that. I know you disagree. A jury could find that that's extreme and outrageous. So let's just put that aside and not argue about what a jury would find. But a jury could find that it was. And I don't know that why we have to identify exactly what was outrageous about this when there's like three or four different possibilities. But the victim heard it. And it did cause her harm. And it was extreme and outrageous. That's what... the elements are, and it just sounds to me that the only, correct me if I'm wrong, the only thing you say that stands in the way of liability is that the perpetrator didn't intend for her to hear it?
If you've taken away my argument that it doesn't meet the outrageousness, then that's the other argument we've made, is that there's a lack of intent here. And
But there is intent to cause her harm. It's just not the particular harm. Like, I intend to embarrass you in front of the police, but then you overheard me saying it. So just because all you did was overhear me saying it, that's not what I intended, then I'm free of liability if I'm Principal James?
I think she cannot be held liable for the comments themselves because she did not intend for them
to. Recklessness, it's intent or recklessness. I don't know why you...
I'm sorry, I just mean that as a shorthand. I'm not trying to dispute that.
Then let's use a shorthand, reckless.
Okay.
Child's right outside the door. Even more relevantly, as far as I'm concerned, the people who are right within earshot and to whom these comments are directed are the people that are supposed to protect that child.
A couple points, Your Honor. I don't think there's evidence that Principal James knew that they were right outside the door. And there certainly is no evidence that she had a reason to think that these comments were being secretly
reported. Well, there's testimony that they were right outside the door. And I think a jury could infer that they're not going to go walk a mile away when someone just runs out in distress. And she tests, I think Jane said that she could hear, not understand the words, to be clear, but could hear the voices in there talking. So they weren't that far away.
I don't think Jane's knowledge speaks to whether Principal Jane was reckless. No, I'm.
Why is it not reckless to say this directly, intentionally to the people who are supposed to do the investigating?
I mean, I take the point that I think it could be reckless in a sort of everyday sense of that word. But I think for these
purposes, everyday sense.
I think to be reckless in this sense, it would need Principal James would have to assume that they are then going to tell that it's likely that they're going to turn around and tell Jane these things. And I don't think that makes any sense. And I don't think that Jane Doe has ever made that argument. In fact, I don't think there's any argument in her brief that proffers a distinct theory of how this satisfies a recklessness standard if it does not satisfy the intent standard. Unless the court has any further questions, we'd ask that you affirm.
I don't think you ever addressed Holman versus Goyle and why that doesn't stand for the proposition that the perpetrator doesn't have to know intend that the victim would know that they did this.
I confess, I don't think I'm familiar with that case. Is it in the briefing?
I'm not sure if my law clerk found it or if it was in the briefing, but it's a defendant giving the stalker information about the plaintiff, knowing full well that the stalker will use that information to harass the plaintiff. And then the stalker does that. It doesn't seem like...
That sounds right to me, and I just don't think that lines up with the facts here.
It just seems that you don't have to intend the victim to know that you're doing it. So if Principal James... Principal James is tanking the investigation, Jane finds out about it, that upsets her.
The distinction is, in that case, it sounds like that the defendant intended the harm.
Intended the acts that caused the harm.
Yes, and it sounds like from the facts of that case...
You just wanted to say intending the harm, which is a different thing. Intending the acts that caused the harm.
But I think the IAD tort requires intent as to the result of extreme emotional distress. I think that's the case law, and I don't think James ever disputed that. So that's that case...
You intend the acts to intend the harm, or you intend the acts knowing that harm will ensue, or recklessness whether harm will ensue.
I think this tort is both. I think they have to be intentional acts that you either intend or are reckless as to the result that they are going to cause. But that sounds like a scenario where, sure, that defendant sounds like they intended their acts and intended them to have the extreme emotional distress. And that's the piece that I think we don't have here.
Thank you very much, Counselor. Ms. Murray, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, I believe that there's no question that this claim should have gone to a jury. What's required to prove intentional infliction of emotional distress is extreme or outrageous conduct that intentionally or recklessly causes the plaintiff severe emotional distress. What we posit the court got backwards here is that the court analyzed the intent and solely the intent as intentional and did not analyze the comments themselves as for what they were. There is case law in the district, the Bushrod case and the Walden case, which requires that you analyze the outrageousness of the conduct first, and that is because subjective intent can rarely be proven. That's a quote from Walden. And what you're entitled to as a litigant is if you can show that the comments conduct was objectively outrageous, it can be inferred to, it can be used to infer the existence of intent on the part of the speaker actor.
I think it's clear, or a jury could find that it's clear that there was extreme outrageous conduct that was intended to harm Jane, but the actual harm to her was different from what was intended. Because if the intent was to tank the investigation, but the harm was that she overheard it, and that's what upset her, there's a disconnect within the theory. And that's what I'm struggling with.
Sure. So I think the harm is not just that she overheard it, but the harm is that, you know, she's a victim of a sexual assault that's going to her principal, who's the person who's tasked to investigate this, tasked to be reported to make the report that this occurred. She's putting her, her fate in these administrators' hands, And instead of objectively doing this, they, you know, obviously James makes these comments. She does eventually hear these comments, and it does have a negative impact on her.
No, there's no doubt, I think, that part of it's proved, or a jury could so find.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is proving the intentional infliction of the actual harm, because intent implies that the perpetrator intended the harm. And what Principal James was saying in the meeting tended to, it was disrespectful, et cetera, but her intent seemed to be to embarrass Jane and tank the investigation. But she didn't intend to harm Jane by Jane hearing her saying these things and then amplifying her trauma. So it just seems like there was extreme outrageous conduct. It did cause harm, but the intent of the extreme outrageous conduct was to tank the investigation and embarrass her in a different way than what actually happened, which was she overheard what was said, and that's what really upset her. And I haven't been able to find any case law that kind of addresses this. There's an intent to harm, but the actual harm is different from what was intended.
I believe that the existing case law, so the cases I just cited, Bushrod and Walden, that establish the intentional or reckless standard, I think that's where there's the sort of key here. These comments, if we're just talking about the comments, and I think we do have to talk also about the
reckless that she would overhear it, or is it just reckless that it would tank them?
Well, I think it's
reckless in what sense?
I
for our purposes.
I actually think it's all of it, Your Honor. So I think it's reckless in the context in which they were made, the fact that it would be easy for her to overhear it, but also in the context in which she's making these, bringing this allegation to them and conducting the investigation. I mean, the harm that occurred as a result of James's conduct is not just the fact that she overheard these comments. It's also the fact that James deliberately misconstrued what was on the video to Dr. Pinder. That caused a delay in the transfer. I think there's another element.
It caused the emotional distress because she didn't know about that.
Well, she did know about the delay. She certainly felt the delay, Your Honor. So that's, I think that that's established as part of the record.
I'm just trying to think about general tort law principles. You have tortious action and intent or recklessness, with the requisite mens rea with the tortious action. If the harm that you occasion is not when you attended but was recently foreseeable, so tortfeasor still responsible for it?
I believe so under a recklessness standard, Your Honor. I think if it was just intentional, it would not be, but under recklessness, I think it would be.
Because how many other people were in the room when
there are two other people in the room and one on a phone.
One on a phone. So three other people. I assume none of them were sworn to secrecy. There's no evidence that James said.
It's not certainly not under oath.
Okay. I don't know. I'm like in first year torts here, trying to think about if I'm going to pull out a gun because my intent is to scare somebody and to cause them emotional trauma because I'm mad at them or for whatever reason, and instead the consequence is it's been snowing or icy or something, and they try to run away from me and slip and fall on the ice and break their leg. I assume I'm responsible for that broken leg, even though I only intended emotional trauma.
I believe under that scenario, it would be
Paul's graph.
If you knew of the circumstances,
it's a different harm than what
right.
You intended some kind of harm. It's a different one that results, but it's not
unforeseeable.
It's reasonably foreseeable that these words would come to her ears.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I have. If I may, Your Honor, yeah. I have just another point about Gebser, which was discussed at length. That case, and counsel touched on this, but in that case, that was a teacher who was sexually harassing a student, and they found under principles of agency that teacher's conduct could not be extrapolated to the administrators. I think what we have here is a different situation. This is not a school administrator sexually assaulting a student, as was the case there. This is a school administrator acting with deliberate indifference through her various comments and actions after the sexual assault was reported to her. I believe that under Gebser, that's a completely different analysis. And I think that this actually falls squarely within Gebser in terms of the school having actual knowledge of a report of the sexual assault and then taking contrary and discriminatory actions after that. So I believe James's conduct can be extrapolated to the school under Gebser. With respect to retaliation, there's a case that we're relying on, Doe versus Manor College, where a student was retaliated against after reporting sexual harassment, and the retaliation included sanctioning her. And I think that is something that is akin to what occurred in this case with the marking of the absences and putting her.
Was there some judgment evidence at all, or a majority of the marked absences should have been excused?
There's no evidence that the majority should have been excused, Your Honor. But there's evidence that I think it's something like 19 should have been excused, 10 were ultimately excused. And again, our claim is that her condition by the time that this was overturned, of course, had snowballed in terms of what was going on with her mentally, physically, in terms of her mental health and being able to participate fully in school.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Both counsel, the case is submitted.